Hello, everybody. Chris Martinson here. And today we're going to be talking about finance and economics as part of Finance U. Remember, anything that you see in this video and all resources available at our websites or affiliated websites are not intended as or construed as financial advice. This is for educational purposes. Remember, if you have a financial decision, please consult a financial professional. We are not attorneys. We're not CPAs. We are not financial managers. As well, we do our best to be accurate. And everything we represent is as accurate as we know it to be. Now, let's turn to our program.
One of the easiest ways for them to stay in power and get out of this is to let inflation reduce the burden of that debt. So at some point, you know, the market shifts. Now, I don't know if gold moving and cocoa moving and coffee moving and, you know, silver hasn't taken off yet, but we're starting to see some popping and cracking as you see creaking popping around the edges.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this edition of Finance University. Very pleased to be back with my good friend, Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management. Paul, how are you today? I like your lighting today. Looks good.
Thank you. I'm learning and adapting a little bit as we go along. So thank you very much. I'm good. Spring weather, 80 degrees here recently. I was outside all weekend. It was so nice. So doing well.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've been planting fruit trees, the ever hopeful spring activity of, you know, parking things in the ground. And yeah, the cows are still held off in their winter paddock because we got to let the pastures advance enough so we can let them on there. So this is the great tension. You have 3,000 pounds of hungry animal being held back by this little wire.
It
shows you it's all in the head.
That's right. It's amazing how good that wire works. Yeah, I've been planting my garden, getting my garden ready to plant here April 23rd, I think it is. So looking forward to that and a good spring and summer.
Well, good. So let's turn to markets then. A lot going on. Let me show you what's been catching my eye lately. So I've been talking about this with my subscribers and not that one. I will find it. Yeah, so Paul, can we talk about the Japanese yen? You and I have gone there before. Here's the Japanese yen. It's cranking out here at 154.32 to the dollar. So it's way under a penny. It's like, you know, 2/3 of a penny right now. But we've been watching it. This is in this chart is getting weaker as it climbs up. And then we see these slams. See that big giant candle down. And look at this one. These are central bank interventions. I'm 99% sure. And they've been coming in and they just haven't been working like they're supposed to. They're expending an extraordinary amount of firepower. Mm-hmm. If they lose control of the yen, we're going to see some really crazy things happen, including we'll see the 10-year yield really spike because that's been the mechanism for decades. And again, they could break the mechanism. Maybe, I don't know, maybe the central bank in the United States spots them some dollars. But the normal mechanism is your currency's diving. So you buy it with what? Well, it's diving against the dollar. So I'm going to buy it with dollars. Where do I get dollars from? I have to sell treasuries.
Yes.
So that's why you would see treasuries climb and they would use that to help support the yen. That's it's been true for decades. Maybe now it's not. I don't know. But it seems important. And I think talking about this leads us into gold, you know, because yes, I think there's a signal there too. Related somehow.
It does. You know, and I don't know when the yen carry trade is going to come apart. And obviously there's massive attempts to try to keep this from unwinding. But from an institutional level, this is something that investors, traders, and institutions have been utilizing as that yen carry trade for, you know, a good 25, 30 years. Some of them their whole career. Like they don't know any other way to do it. They know other ways to do it, but this has been a very profitable trade for them over the long term. So you've got a lot of complacency in there. Oh, surely they're not going to let this happen. But that chart reminds me very similar to that gold breakout after, you know, hitting resistance. You know, at first when gold broke out, we knew it was a big deal. But I was kind of cynical from the standpoint of, hey, we're going to have a back test really quickly. But we haven't at this point. We've carried that momentum forward. So, you know, gold at this point has signaled that there's issues in the system somewhere. And what's fascinating is, you know, it's not U.S. retail investors. I mean, whoever this is that's the buyer out there, is they're not blinking, right? Like I'm talking to a lot of retail investors that even gold bugs at this point are like, should I really chase the price here? Should I really allocate to it, right? Like, I've been buying it at lower prices. Mm-hmm. Is this too high? Is it going to come back lower? Whoever's buying is an insensitive buyer. So it's there's something going on under the surface, and we don't see it yet. I thought we were starting to see it last weekend. Maybe that's why gold broke out, you know, with the increased tensions between Iran and Israel. But right now, not. So I'm watching that yen carry trade to see how quickly that one breaks.
Yeah. So when that breaks, a big deal. But to the gold, I read 5 gold articles this week in the United States, and they were all gold unfriendly. Oh, pawn shops in Brooklyn are full of people turning their gold in. Oh, GLD investors are, you know, coughing up tons and tons of gold. Like, all of them were all about how retail investors, like, if you want to be part of the in crowd, sell your gold fillings in grandma's ring, right? I mean, it was really gross to watch this, you know? Yeah. But I think it's part of the programming. Somebody's interested in having the little people cough up their gold, but we can tell from the price action some big people want it.
Yeah, there's some big people out there that want it. You know, and it's always funny, there's an individual or two around town, you know, all of us have those snarky individuals in our life, and I always get it at the gym. And I'm back into the gym for the first time in a while, which is really nice. I'm not going to be able to walk tomorrow. But, you know, individual comes up to me first thing. He's like, hey, I'm glad gold price is high. Not only did I sell it, I'm thinking about shorting it. And I thought, oh, well, that tells you the retail demand on gold right there, you know, from that standpoint. Mm-hmm. There's just not a belief that this is a breakout. You know, and all throughout history, Coca-Cola had a similar basing effect in the 1990s. And when it broke out of that resistance level, it ran for quite some time. I mean, I believe that this is a real deal, especially we've stayed above these highs and carried that momentum, because everything has been a headwind for gold right now. Dollar strong. Yields have been spiking. The Fed's, you know, quasi-hawkish in their talk. Not, you know, one side of their mouth, they act like they're so desperate to cut rates. But mm-hmm. then they come out, you know, and seem hawkish, and yields haven't cracked yet. That's normally a bad environment for gold. So can you imagine what's the price is going to do when the tailwind gets behind gold at this point, if they cut rates and the dollar starts to crack? So, you know, the unique opportunity for investors who have the courage and willingness and the tools to help them, you know, adapt and take advantage of that. Not a recommendation, just an education and discussion here to put it on people's radar.
Absolutely. So related to that, let me turn to silver real quick, because I am a silver bug, no question about it. I like it a lot for, because I'm a fundamental investor at heart. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm about to put out a piece, Paul, that's titled, Thank You for Wasting My Time. Somebody's been wasting my time for a long time. This is a long-term price of silver chart starting back here in about 2002. And you can see it's barely here now at 28-something, 28.50. It's coming up against this resistance right here, but it barely will get back to where it was 10 years ago, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's, you know, that's it. So silver's gone nowhere for 10 years. Thank you for wasting a decade of my life. And I'm a little salty about that because of this. So the Silver Institute puts out surveys, and you trust these data as much as you want, up to you. But here, let me expand this a little so it's even bigger, so we can see it even easier here, hopefully. Yeah, now you can see a little better. So here you can see this is 2015 and 16, 17, 18, 19 on up through 2023 is in the bag now. In 2024, they have a forecast. That's why it has an F. And we cut to the chase, and it says that, well, in 2023, a minus 184 million ounce deficit here, right? In the year before, there was a minus 263. This is even before investment demand. Investment demand is this next layer down here, so it could be worse or better depending on whether investment people coughed up or bought more, but just on a pure structural, how much supply, how much demand without investment. And the year before that was minus, you know, 95 million ounces. And the year before that was minus 30. And the year before that was minus 4 million ounces. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years in structural shortfall, mm-hmm. right? 1, 2, 3 years of surplus, but another year of structural shortfall. So out of the last 10 years, we have 7 out of 10 years it's in shortfall. And look what the projection for forecast, minus 215 million ounces short for next, for this 2024, if their forecast is accurate. Find me something where what we see is prices going nowhere when you are in structural shortfall the whole time. It's a bizarre thing. So, that's why I like silver. I just like things where I think they've got the story wrong. Right. This is an example where I think they've got the story wrong, at least on Wall Street, at least out there in the paper games. Because again, the price of silver is not set between you're a mine, I'm a manufacturer. We come to some fair price that makes sense given market dynamics, right? That's not how silver is priced. It's priced in the United States, in our paper markets, by people who have an unlimited capacity to just throw out paper silver anytime they want, as much as they need. And they've right. done an extraordinary amount of that this past couple of weeks. Like huge amounts.
Yes, they have.
Like 1 year of world mine output was shorted this last week alone. Right. It's an extraordinary condition, right? So,
well,
I don't know.
You think about that. I mean, you've got supply that's shrinking relatively dramatically, but yet our money supply is expanding dramatically. Could you imagine what house prices would do if we were shrinking in housing supply by that rate over a period of time? But houses tend to be popular, and that's something the politicians like to point towards. The bad thing about silver going through the roof and gold going through the roof is it basically pulls the rug out or drains the pool for naked central bankers, right? You know, it lowers that water so we can see who's swimming naked, to you know, as Warren Buffett would say. But you know, one thing I like to point out from a longer term standpoint, because, and I'll share my screen with you here and see, and looking at silver, when silver moves historically, it moves quickly. Bear with me. I'm having a hard time finding my screen there. So I think you can see that, Kinch Chris. So
sure
this is a quarterly chart of silver going back to 1975. Of course, you had the Hunt brothers tried to corner the market in the early 1980s and it drops. But the last time gold was closer to $1,800 an ounce was in 2011-12 when silver jumped up to that long-term, you know, top, that peak that it had in the interim period. Well, there's a couple of things taking place. When we settled back in 2015-16, that white line's a 200 quarter moving average. So we actually held that. We came up, established a resistance line, a trend line, and we've broken out of this. So there's all kinds of indications in here that, yeah, we've got a few more hurdles to get through, but silver looks like it wants to run. Even in the short run, we've had some breakouts here. We got to clear through this level. But silver, you know, is up 14% here in the past month. And it's up, you know, here in the past week. We've got to get through that line. But once we break through that line, you're probably going to see silver move, you know, relatively quickly to play some catch up with the gold price move. So, again, not a recommendation, but I'm with you. That's one of the most attractive charts out there. But you got to be a patient investor in this environment because you've got a lot of forces that have a vested interest in keeping these silver prices down.
Yeah. Yeah. So you'd think, though, so when I say, you know, there's these paper players, you remember, I know you remember this, Paul, in the London Metal Exchange last year or so, there was this famous case where there was one player that was short nickel, right? And it was a big Chinese firm. And they were just short like crazy. And then that trade blew up on them, right? It happens, right? And the job of a metal exchange, any clearinghouse, any brokerage, is to make sure that they're balancing that aspect. And so they have what are called position limits, right? Which says, yeah, I wouldn't want any one party to get too over the tips of their skis because I'm actually on the hook for this. I'm supposed to be the clearing party, making sure appropriate margin is in the account. So if this goes against this party, if they fail, these people still get paid because that's my whole job. I'm just here to create a safe place for trading to happen. So the London Metal Exchange learned its lesson, and we wake up today to read about this. Short squeeze fears grip tin as the London Metal Exchange says it's watching the market. And why are they watching the market? Because it turns out a single trader is holding futures position in tin equivalent to over 90% of the volume held in the LME warehouses. So lesson not learned. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. And you're like, wow, these markets, how can they get so crazy? It's because the regulators are totally asleep at the wheel. You should never allow this to happen. And the same shenanigans are happening in the silver market all the time. Mm-hmm. People know about it. JP Morgan is allegedly 25 or more percent of the silver market. That's too much of a concentrated position. Mm-hmm. Yet they hold it.
Yes.
And here we are. The good news for people who follow these things is, well, if that's the case, then there's always the chance that they've got it wrong and that they're subsidizing your ability to participate.
That's right.
Which is always a good thing.
Well, and it keeps it out of sight and out of mind. It keeps those investors complacent. It keeps them, you know, concerned, unbelieving that these breakouts are a real deal because they've successfully driven those prices back down in the past. But yet our money supplies continue to grow, our national debt has continued to grow, and fiat currencies all come to the same end throughout history. We just don't know how close we are to that end. So it just doesn't make sense that you've got metals like that aren't moving. Hey, I'll tell you what's interesting. Did you hear about coffee? People have been talking about here recently, coffee's had a substantial breakout. So it's not out to all-time highs. But let me
share. Is that because it's next on the alphabetical list after cocoa? Is that?
Yeah, cocoa took off. It did, didn't it? So let me share my screen with you here so you can see it if you've not seen that. So, you know, you can see here, this is coffee going back to about 2020, March of 2020. And you can see it's kind of trickled down.
Big wedge.
Boom, just this substantial move up here over the past week or so, about 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't necessarily know what it means, but
yeah,
we are seeing a lot of, maybe there's one trader that got cornered over there too, but we are starting to see signs of things breaking out on a big scale in the commodities area. I mean, I got my auto insurance bill here recently and I hand it to Renee, you know, she kind of takes care of paying some of those. And she came downstairs. She said, is this right? Something's wrong. Did you add two or three more cars? I'm like, no, I haven't changed anything. It just went up that much. So,
I know.
Now that brings me to Chris. So, in talking about gold breaking out,
well, I can't hold on. We got to throw cocoa up just for fun. I mean, this is your chocolate, people. I mean, whatever. So that's quite the chart right there. Pure you parabola. Know,
what's interesting about that, isn't there the weight loss pill out there that causes people not, or injection that causes people not to eat anymore? So wouldn't there be less demand in cocoa? You know, so why is that price moving like that with the backdrop back there, right?
It must be that you and I don't know, but apparently cocoa cures hair loss and erectile dysfunction. We don't know, right?
That's good. It's the next.
We don't know. We just interpret the signs. Yeah, there it is. Again, neither medical nor investment advice. Just saying. Okay.
Right. So one thing that I want to put on the radar that brings me to a concern that's been rolling around in my head for the past couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of investors who have been seeking yield like crazy, especially 2010 through 2020. When the Federal Reserve drove interest rates down to 1%. So a lot of investors were going out in 20 and 25 and 30-year bonds. Now, when I started in the industry back in the late 1990s, I'll never forget, you know, the company that I was with sells a lot of bonds. And they're like, okay, when you call somebody to sell a bond, because you get in the investment business, you're a salesman first, and then you got to accumulate enough clients so you can become an asset manager or financial advisor, work with them. You got to prove yourself, right? So you got to go out and sell. So they're like, when you call people, you need to sell these 30-year bonds because they're pretty profitable for us. We're getting them out of our inventory. They pay pretty high commissions and they're not going to want to tie that money up for 30 years. So what you tell them is say, hey, if you're lucky, you'll get to keep this for 30 years because it's such a great interest rate, but you're only guaranteed to keep it for 10 years because that's the non-callable window. So the company's more than likely going to buy that back from you. Well, what we've seen, and let me get over to this screen, I'll share it with you. We've got a backdrop where investors, okay, hang on. Let me cancel that share. Let me pull it up so I don't have to search it through. There it is. All right, bear with me. So what we've seen, and this is the period of time that investors have dealt with, what I'm showing here is the 30-year U.S. Treasury, and this is the yield. Okay, so going back to 1985 over here on this left corner. So from 1985, you've had this series of lower lows and lower highs. So we've been in a trend that's been down, that's, you know, in the general area of that orange line that's coming down. And it came to, it's an inevitable conclusion, you know, unless we went to negative rates forever, right here on the other side of COVID, the path of least resistance had to be higher at some point, and we have changed in that direction. But you've got over a 40-year window here where investors are used to interest rates going lower. And what happens from a business standpoint, if I'm a company and I've, you know, given you a 30, I borrowed money from you for 30 years at 7.5%, and I'm locked in where I have to pay you that for 10 years. Well, of course, at the end of 10 years, if I can refinance that for, you know, from here down to this period of time at 4.7, I'm obviously going to refinance that. So this is something, a story that Wall Street has sold. Advisors have sold. It's just second nature to them over this period of time. But I believe that we're in a regime change now where this is not just a temporary breakout and interest rates getting higher. This is going to be a generational move. We're going to see those move higher. All of the data tells you that the interest rates move in 40-year cycles. So
now, before you move off of that chart, so I'm just interested, if you kind of draw a line over from that new peak, how do you go back more than 10 years? So that story where you tell people, don't worry, it'll get called out in 10 years. And by the way, when it gets called out, reminder folks, yields and prices move in opposition to each other in bonds. So as the yield is falling, the price is going up. So if you get that called in 10 years, you probably have a capital gain on that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You made money. That's fun. Hey, they called it, but I made money. How far back do we have to go to an equivalent yield? How many years?
You're talking about 2011 right now. Okay.
Great. So bonds probably aren't getting called anymore.
No, not if they stay in this area, because, you know, if you go back to that, let's say I issued a tremendous amount of bonds in 2020, right? Or I issued a tremendous amount in 2019, just to show that level. You know, look at this chart, even through all of this 40-year period of time, look how much of that, how many years of that window that rates were above that. Okay. So this was an anomaly.
Yeah.
The problem is these investors are going to be stuck in these lower yielding securities. And if they're lucky, right, we get a cut. The Federal Reserve gets what they seem to be so desperate to do, is cut interest rates. And that gives them the opportunity to sell those. So, you know, that's my biggest concern looking out there. And what investors need to stop sharing, what investors need to realize, imagine a seesaw on the playground. Right. So I can't demonstrate a seesaw here, but in my right hand, I think that would be your right hand. This is interest rates and this is bond values. So if I buy a 30-year bond at, you know, I put $100,000 in it and it's paying me 5%. If rates go up, the value of that bond goes down. Okay. And you'll get your money back at maturity if it's something that's guaranteed. But the problem is you may be below that value for a long period of time because investors demand a current interest rate. So as rates go up, the value of your bond, the market value of your bond goes down because you have to compensate the buyer for the yield, the maturity. So they're taking a lower interest rate. They take lower cash flow on that. But that difference in that bond dropping compensates them for the yield to maturity. So if you bought it at 5%, and I'm not doing the math in my head, and rates go to 7, right? That bond is going to drop enough to where that 5% yield and that growth back to maturity is going to be your yield to maturity. So, you know, one of the interesting things, there are times that's easy for me to talk to people about adding things. So there are a couple of things that are really hard for people right now. And when it's hard, a good advisor, our job is, I tell clients, there's times where I'm going to grab you by the belt buckle and I'm going to be pulling you back a little bit because you're getting out over your skis and you're carrying too much risk. There's going to be times where I'm behind you, I'm planting my hands on your back and I'm pushing you forward. Ryan, I'm talking people through this, but just a picture of what we need to do. So right now, there's a tremendous amount of resistance to people that I'm talking to in general about their long maturing bonds, right? There's a tremendous amount of complacency out there. And what we have to be concerned about is our national debt is ridiculous. our government is so fiscally irresponsible that they have to tell us that it's a fiscally responsible plan. Go figure. And, you know, and we know that they're one of the easiest ways for them to stay in power and get out of this is to let inflation reduce the burden of that debt. So at some point, you know, the market shifts. Now, I don't know if gold moving and cocoa moving and coffee moving and, you know, silver hasn't taken off yet, but we're starting to see some popping and cracking as you see creaking popping around the edges. I love it when you put those alerts out, Chris. So, you know, we're starting to see things move. Is this the event? I don't know, but there's going to be a lot of investors out there that are complacent in these long bonds that are going to get in trouble. So, one thing I'm encouraging people to consider in the situation that they're in is use any pullbacks in interest rates or consider dollar cost averaging out, you know, because you carry a lot of risk. You carry a tremendous amount of inflation risk if you're 30 years or 15 or 20, and shortening that up, if we are in a higher interest rate environment for longer, is a very wise decision from a long-term standpoint.
Yeah, indeed. So can I talk? I love the creaking popping because, you know, we're out here in the cheap seats, so we're trying to make sense of it. And by the way, I think everybody who's not sitting on the FOMC is in the cheap seats to some extent.
That's true.
Just saying. So two things, because I think these both impact enormously as we go forward. The first is this. Remember we had this big mysterious blow off that happened in starting in October, November, that boundary of 2023. And next thing you know, we just saw like, you know, 15 out of 16 weeks, the Dow is up and things are exploding. Bitcoin's up, gold's up, everything's going up. At least part of that was because, you know, the Fed really wanted to expand its balance sheet again, but it couldn't politically. It didn't have to, because it had cranked out so much cash during COVID. It was just parked out there. And part of it was sitting in what were called excess reserves. And those ended up in what are called overnight reverse repurchase agreements, RRPs. Look what they had to work with, $2.4 trillion. They've worked it down to, say, $0.4 trillion, just to do the math in my head super easy. $2 trillion. This is what's been supporting bond prices. This has all been flowing off into bonds. $2 trillion. Paul, you and I are old enough that you know that there was a day in the past where that number would have been unbelievable, literally. Mm-hmm. With disbelief, you would have said, no, that's stupid. Trillions of dollars just sort of flowing around, right? That's dumb. So when we get back to Jesse Felder, and by the way, folks, this is the kind of analysis I'm providing. This is just a daily comment back here. I do these things called scouting reports for my subscribers 3 times a week, and this one was yesterday's. And somebody asked a question. And so this person's like, he thinks, Thomas, thinks that we're going 10 years going to 8%. I was like, whoa, 8%, not historically high, but dude, think of the impact on household and government budgets, et cetera. But when we look at this period, Paul, this massive 45, 50 degree, like ruler straight thing, something freaked him out right here. I don't know what it was, but I do know that they started pounding on this and just, you know, putting trillions back into the markets. And Jesse Felder was writing back in February, he said the easing of financial conditions during that period of time was equivalent to 100 basis points of rate cuts. That's the eased financial conditions, right? And so the thing that's just bothersome to me, because I'm this kind of a guy, I'm a Virgo, when Jerome Powell comes out with his little like, oh, we're surprised by inflation, I'm like, no, you shouldn't be. Not when you liberated $2 trillion into the markets, dude. You eased financial conditions by 100 basis points, you know? But stealth, they didn't do it through the front door. This was back door, and he knew what he's doing, and then he has to go out and play dumb about inflation. But it's angering, right? Because real people get really hurt by these inflation moves. I know you have to struggle with this because, you know, you've got people have to plan. They're on retirement, the fixed incomes, whatever the story is. Inflation hurts real people. The Fed does this on purpose and then plays dumb. And I hate that. I wish they would just come out and say, we've decided to let inflation run. We're using these tools. We're hurting people. We know it, but we think it's worth it because dot, dot, dot. And they should be able to explain themselves.
Yes.
But they never should. Do.
No.
They never do.
And it's just that lack of honesty. They think we're too stupid to figure it out on our own. And, you know, and I guess they think that they're, have control over all levers to where they can pull this off, and, you know, but there are some desperate moves that are out there, you know, and the question is, why did they have to intervene so heavily where we are right now? Right. Is it political? Are they that desperate? Why in the world? I still don't understand. Yeah. One day it's hawkish, but everything that the Federal Reserve Chairman seems to be doing is trying to cut interest rates, right? Trying to cut interest rates. So, you know, is it about the election? Is it trying to make things look really good until then, or remove that as a decision-making process? I don't know. But what I can say is it makes it very important for investors where they are today. We're at a point where interest rates, for example, that was a 40-year trend that was in place. That trend is broken. Mm-hmm. Gold's been fighting since 2012 to break out of that 1900-2000 level range. It has broken out. You've had a lot of these things that have been in place for the past, you know, 15, 20 years that are changing now. And the question is, for investors that have been complacent, you know, hand it over. These same people want you to hand it over to them, put it in an index that's non-managed. Don't pay any attention to it. Oh, by the way, don't call me and have any questions, because I'm not going to spend time looking at it. You just need to trust, pay me a fee to sit there and, you know, hold it in that index. Is that going to work for the next 10, 15, 20 years? I really don't think that it is. I don't think that it will, because we're at a point where normal cycles and cyclicals and seasons take place, and this one's coming to an end. And for those investors who are adaptive and have a process to help them navigate uncertain times, you know, an instrument-rated pilot is one that I want to fly with on a commercial plane. I don't want to fly on a commercial plane with your weekend warrior, right? So, you know, we're seeing a lot of things change. There's going to be unbelievable amounts of opportunity, but there's also going to be many dangerous pitfalls or pits that we can get into if we're not paying attention. This is not a time for investors to be complacent.
No, indeed it's not. And I've said this before, but one of the things I do not like is, I think the, you know, they had those signs on the old antique stores, you break it, you buy it. You know, I think the central banks have broken our markets. I really do. I think they're not my daddy's markets, right? They're not even the markets of my childhood. They're markets. I put air quotes around them because they've become fictions, right? And one of the ways I detect those fictions is because of charts like this. This is all sorts of indices. This is on a weekly basis. So this is stretching back. This is, we got about a little over a year here, right? And so you see the Dow Jones has this shape. The NASDAQ, which is technology shares, has this shape. The Nikkei, which is totally unrelated and is just a agglomeration of 225 largest Japanese companies, has this shape. And the German DAX has this shape. And they're almost indistinguishable. Now, I do think that this is potential break and trend. We'll find out how much they freak out about these little downward wiggles here. Again, Euro stocks, same thing. But this is interesting to me. The only sour note in here, Paul, would be the Russell 2000 small caps. Mm-hmm. We can go back all more than a year and nothing, and they are now in negative territory. Right?
That's right.
These, I consider these to be a little bit more business sensitive and interest rate sensitive. So if there is something coming, I tend to look here first, not to the S&P. But still, point one, you know, we have all these, like, there's no financial bulkheads. When Japan is the same as Germany, is the same as technology, which is the same as S&P 500, there's no financial bulkheads. There's no, like, oh, well, we'll diversify. Like, into what? They traded identically. They've broken the markets, and I think that's why they're going to have to buy them.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you know, and I, this is not a prediction, but this is what I can't help run through my head, and I like the theme. So we had the Magnificent Seven, which is now the Six, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, so we got six. Tesla's fallen by the wayside. A couple of others are kind of teetering on the edge. So you could say it's the Magnificent Five, four, three, two, one, impact, right? Because in these cap-weighted index, with the Russell 2000 not taking off and it's showing some weakness too, the cap-weightedness of and the large percentage of those Magnificent Seven in these cap-weighted indexes, you know, you could very easily say they will initiate the countdown to major troubles that are there. Major troubles here sooner rather than later.
Yeah. And where do you look when you're saying, hey, this might be rolling over? I know you have a system for this, but what do you watch?
Well, you know, one of the things that we watch is kind of the underlying momentum of the market. Plus, we look at the Russell 2000, the breadth of the market, how many stocks are participating. You know, this is a pretty dangerous time where we are right now. We've been through a strong run. Okay. Now, my tools don't tell me this. They tell us that the momentum is strong and that you have to err towards the side of offense right now, but you still need to do it prudently. And all the historical data shows that we should have a pullback here in the short run with momentum carrying in the summer. 80% of these similar environments, you've seen the market head higher, but those 20% is where things can get hairy. So you look at participation across the board and money flows, right? Money flows tells you a lot. So when you have what's called on-balance volume, which it tells you on balance, did we have more sellers than we had buyers? You can still have price go up when you've got more sellers than you have buyers just because of the way the trades come into the market. Money flows, one of the most important things that we pay attention to, because when that ball of money starts moving out of the Magnificent Seven, for example, into commodities, that gives you an indication that commodity prices have the potential for a sustained long-term uptrend, or if it's moving out of the U.S. So money flow, momentum, and then support and resistance levels. You know, if you have a, let's say we're standing on the second floor, and the floors are 10 feet in those buildings, if there's not a solid foundation and we're jumping up and down, when that floor starts cracking and it breaks, right, how far is it down to the next support level? If it's 2 or 3 feet, might sprain your ankle, right? So if we've got real close support, that gives us the ability to let the markets or an individual stock move. But if you're 20 feet to the bottom of the next floor, you're going to break some legs, if not worse. So those are some of the factors we pay attention to, but money flow and momentum is very important in our analysis of the overall markets.
Well, how do you factor in, like, it's a political year and politicians always like to spend more. We're already spending like drunken sailors, or
Yeah.
I don't know what's even worse than drunken sailors, but that's what we're doing at the federal level. And we just saw that John Podesta came out and said, you know, if gas prices get a little high, we've always got the SPR. He didn't commit to selling more out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And I think Podesta is Italian for sketchy art buyer. Anyway, those of you who know, I'm not going any further with that, but I don't like taking advice from that guy, that's for sure.
It's fun.
On anything. But no, they've threatened to unleash the SPR to do whatever they will do whatever they need to do to try
Yeah.
and buy their way into this election. They've already said, hey, we'll just release, you know, student loan people. You know, that's great. And I'm like, well, what about my mortgage? You know, or what about my credit card? Can you release those too, please? You know,
Yeah.
so do you factor that in? Election year shenanigans? Is that part of this story?
Well, you know, yeah, you take it into consideration, but the reality is that those headlines that are there, they matter from an emotional standpoint, things that we need to pay attention to, but the underlying market structure and money flow will answer more of what the market really wants to do. Now, I can set an expectation. So my expectation based on what the market would be this year, we've had this massive run with the pivot that was not a pivot on the Fed back in November. It's a little stretched. I'm shocked, Chris. I will say this, you know, with the increased tensions that occurred last week with you know, Iran's response to Israel, and yeah, I don't want to go down that whole thing. I did not get one phone call. Not one phone call
Really?
from a concerned client. That's the first time in 26 years that there's been any geopolitical tension. Now, it could be that clients know that we move fast enough because I've got a lot of clients who've been with me for a long time, but I've got a handful of clients out there that it doesn't matter if I've sold yesterday, they're still going to call on a panic. So not one. And I don't know what that means, you know, from a, I think it's a complacency standpoint, right? Like we've had this increased rhetoric over time. You know, you've got this war in Ukraine that's taken place. There's just a complacency out there that they're not going to let this get out of control. Side trail, but back to the election. You know, there's so much effort trying to keep these markets up going into this election this fall. My anticipation, we get a correction. Yeah, it's potential that things could come apart. That's what makes this really hard. We're not going to know in hindsight until something has dramatically changed. Yeah, there's signs that we've got that the market structure has changed. There's signs, but we don't have all of the warning signals going off yet. Once we get there, we'll move dramatically and appropriate for the clients that are there. But pullback momentum could carry us into the summer if something doesn't escalate out of the Middle East. And then all of a sudden, people are going to start paying attention to the election. Speaking of the election, what's fascinating to me in the cycles that I have been through is typically the market will bottom and start moving 30 days prior to the election, because market participants have figured out, you know, what'll work for, you know, what'll work well between both candidates and what won't. So they'll stay away and you start to see the market move. Historically, though, the market doesn't really pay that much attention to the elections. It's a lot to worry about, but there's really not, in most historical cases, there's not major actionable moves that need to be made just because there's an election on the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
This one may be different.
I was just thinking, you know, this administration has shown that it will do anything, including draining our strategic so-called petroleum reserve in order to achieve political ends. So that's kind of an extra thing. On the counterbalancing that, though, I feel like the Federal Reserve is really sort of up against the wall. You know, politically, they can't really do much here for a while because inflation is still a pretty hot topic. You don't have to go far on Twitter or TikTok to find young people really screaming about this, right? Mm-hmm. And they should, right? Because it's just devastatingly high inflation. We know that the government's gaslighting us. Oh, it's only 3.5%. No, it's not. It's 7 to 14%, depending on where I live and what my buying necessities are, right? So if I'm an elderly person renting in San Francisco with a very high prescription drug cost, my inflation is not 3.5%. It's much higher. So I don't think the Fed can do much here. I don't think they can just say, psych, you know, cut rates, expand our balance sheet. You know, I don't think they're going to be able to do that outside of some sort of a initiating financial accident that scares people enough that they could get away with that.
Well, that's what they would need, because otherwise, if inflation gets out of control, and they will risk inflation getting out of control if they act without some type of an event, then they're certainly going to take the blame for it. And I don't think they want to take the blame. Like, nobody wants to take the blame for anything, right? They always want to point the finger at somebody else, and especially those who aren't willing to tell the truth. So, you know, they're signaling, hey, we'd give anything to cut interest rates. I mean, that's my take on what they're saying, but they seem desperate to cut, but they don't quite have the cover for it yet. So the question is what's going to provide the cover for them to cut interest rates? You know, and it just amazes me, the political games that are taking place, right? You know, we're sending money to Ukraine for this war in Russia. I'm not making a political statement, just an observation, but we're sending money over there, right? When there's so many things we could be doing in our country. But yet the Biden administration gets upset because Ukraine attacks some of the oil facilities in Russia, because that would drive oil prices up going into the election. I'm like, do we want a war or do we not? Like, is this just all theater? I don't understand that, you know?
Well, the messaging has been startlingly clear from the U.S. side, which is, oh, Russians are dying? We're for it. Oh, Ukrainians are dying? Hey, you know, that's war. Oh, no. You hit something that might make the oil prices go up? Stop that. Right?
Yeah.
So priorities, it's not human life, right? There's something more important. That's all. It's just a very simple statement to read, right?
So that's very eloquently stated, but that's right. And that's heartbreaking to me. And I don't understand that. And I just don't see how.
Yeah, not,
if that's our. If that's our morals in this country, then everything that built the foundation for us to get where we are is crumbling and coming apart. And you know, traditional investing strategies are going to have to adapt to that.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to be, I know you know this, but just to be crystal clear, these aren't my priorities or my morals at all. It's just, I couldn't be more against these folks and who are currently in charge. Now, speaking of things that, again, none of this is what we would call financial advice. I very rarely pull up a specific thing, but I just want to talk about one thing, because, you know, I did a lot of COVID coverage for a while, eh? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of these charts on here, ooh,
I'm curious to see what it is, Chris. I have no clue, but I'm curious, and I'm going to see if I can guess just looking at the chart.
All right. Sure, here you go. This is starting in 2008, so this is a very long time frame here.
That's exactly what I thought you would pull up, is the big PFE, Pfizer.
And they made these things, the special medical intervention. This is telling me a very strong tail right here. Mm-hmm. It is now down to a level that it was last squinting at this in 2013-ish.
Mm-hmm.
So we have now lost more than 10 years of stock gains.
Mm-hmm.
And appreciation. And so this is telling me, like, I look at this, we have a very sick, let's just pull it back to 5 years. This is not a happy stock right here. And again, not specific advice. I'm over here with a little bit of schadenfreude because, couldn't be happening to a nicer company. What I'm seeing there. And, if people who've been watching my coverage before know that they rushed something through very much unfavorable. I think people are waking up to that. And that stock mm-hmm. price we just saw is reflecting the idea that people are really waking up. And I think there's going to be real consequences for that. I raise this because I think this is going to have real market impacts as well.
Yeah.
Dave Fairtex, who writes for my site, he does a really wonderful, every week he does a very comprehensive financial review. And one of the things he's done is followed up on Ed Dowd's observation that, hey, there's a lot of people who are on the disabled list. And a lot of those people were formerly healthy people, which means we have now a very high level of service wage inflation. And you connect those dots by saying, well, there's 3 million people out of work who shouldn't have been out of work. And you have to compete for the people who remain in those positions. And so that drives wage inflation up, which we call services inflation.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we're starting. There are real economic impacts still circulating around from these decisions that were made. And I think people should be aware of them because, well, if you were a holder of PFE as a stock position, this is something I think you wanted to be aware of.
Absolutely. You know, and that just brings to mind, they made short-term decisions at the expense of the lives of real people to line their own pockets. So if you don't live and operate on a moral basis that where you're serving others and you're doing what's best, and yeah, you make a living doing what's best, but you do what's best for other people, then you're going to pay the pain later. You might get instant gratification in the short run, but there's no way to get away from it. You know, Jordan Peterson highlights, you can lie, but the truth will come out in the end at some point. You may not necessarily be there to suffer the consequences of it, but the truth will come out. And that's one of those situations here. When you look at a stock price like that, you know, that there is pain coming for those executives. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people that have had, you know, life-altering events because of their short-term thinking. And love.
Yeah. Yeah. Very unfortunate. But the theme that's sort of cropping up here, Paul, is that what happens when a people at some level, when we lose our way, our moral way, here's the thing. Nobody should have to write a set of comprehensive laws and rules and restrictions that makes sure that companies don't behave unethically. There's no way, like humans, we're raccoons. You could write as many laws as you want, and we will find a way to get our little digits in there and escape the trap you've laid, right? No. It's got that. Those are secondary. Primary has to be that you've got people who fundamentally care about other people making good decisions because they know that in serving other people well, they do well and everybody does well. So, you know, it has to be that kind of a foundation. Like if I started an entrepreneurship school, it would start with that, right? We'll learn about balance sheets and cash flow statements later. First thing we're going to do is test and see where your morals are at. Because if you're a good person, you'll probably do well.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's a lot of the corporate structure that we've gotten into today with the nepotism and the friend jobs and taking care of those that we like, right? Not the right people. So I don't know any founder of a business, right? Like, I can't tell you. I mean, I started out just myself. We're up to 8 individuals now. But, you know, this team that I have here between Carrie and Renee and Brittany and John and Dylan and Mackenzie, they all care about the people that we serve. And if they haven't, if they didn't, I would have already fired them and they weren't working here. But we all share in the benefits, right? So I've never met a founder of a company that doesn't take very good care of those employees that have grown that company with them. Never met one, right? But I have found a lot of trust fund babies that took over companies, not because they necessarily deserve. Now, this is not saying that all of them are that case, but you know, just because you went to Harvard and you came out does, and your, you know, so-and-so relative or dad's friend was running a company doesn't mean that you deserve to go straight into the C-suite, right? And I think that's the problem within our country in America is the nepotism and the protecting of our own and the lack of morality, right? And I know we all want to do what's right, but there still needs to be that process of discipline and hands-on involved in building that company. We're not in a capitalistic society anymore, and we don't have a justice system that punishes. You know, one of the things I've told my kids growing up, it was best analogy. I don't know who I heard it from, but I was explaining how you need to learn to communicate with people, right? And we're standing there and I see the dog, and I'd heard this somewhere, and I said, I can sit here and tell that dog all day long how much I love it, right? I can sit here and cuss that dog and with a smile on my face, and it doesn't know the difference. The only way that dog knows that I love it is if I get down there and I pet that dog, right? So, you know, sometimes with our kids and raising them, you can talk to them, but unless you have consequences associated with their actions, you're never going to train them in the right direction. Same thing with corporate America. When they get out of line, you've got to have a justice system that punishes them for the protection of the people, or otherwise they're going to end up in a situation where they're raping the people financially on a consistent basis, which is what it seems like we're in a society now, because the justice system is not doing their job because of our lack of morality.
Yep. Yep. Well, very well said. And, as we close this out, I just want to remind everybody that we do have a webinar on how to avoid the great taking. And we have 7 specific strategies. Paul, you're going to be there presenting, talking about one very important set of strategies that people can pursue. And there are things people can do. And unfortunately, we have to do them, because the reality of the situation is those raccoons, those amoral raccoons, got busy and tuned the system so that, you know, in a pinch, heads they win, tails you lose, right? And so that's just the reality of the situation. But there are things we can do. I just think once people are alerted to this and notified, they have a duty to either ignore it consciously,
yeah,
or get busy figuring out what they're going to do about it. And there's really no in between. So people are on alert. Everybody who's watching my channel knows that there's some things to know about and some concerns. And the good news is, I think there are things we can do about it. It took some time to begin to figure them out. But thank you for your willingness to look into that fearlessly, even though it may have worked against your own, you know, business interests, that you did the right thing. And so I just want people to know that whoever's watching this, please find people of really high integrity you can work with on this, because it's really important.
Well, and I appreciate that, Chris, but I wouldn't have it any other way, right? I mean, like, you've done such a good job of educating, and it reminds me, and for those of you that are out there, you know enough about Chris that everything he does is excellent. He puts effort into it. You know, he does the work. And so this is one of those things where I can say, like Proverbs tells us twice, the prudent foresee danger and hide themselves while the simple pass on and are judged for it. So you may not be able to protect yourself from absolutely everything, but you can still be prudent and hide yourself so that you're not judged for it, and you put yourself in a position to help others on the other side of this and protect your family. So I would encourage everybody to participate in that webinar, and you'll still continue to let everybody know as it comes along, I'm sure, Chris.
Well, thank you. And that proverb speaks, but for Texans, you don't want to be armadillo roadkill. For us northern apple farmers, don't be low-hanging fruit, okay?
Don't be low-hanging fruit.
Lots of ways to look at that. All right. Well, thanks again, Paul. We'll be talking to you next week.
I look forward to it. Have a great week, Chris. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye. Hello, Chris Martinson. I'm the CEO of Peak Prosperity and also Peak Financial Investing. And after watching that, you're probably wondering, well, what do I do with my money? Look, you both deserve and need somebody who can talk to you about what's really going on in this world, understand the situation as it is, not be steering you towards certain things that don't make sense for you or just keep you in a game that's already ended. Look, if you want to talk to somebody about the petrodollar declining or what is happening with gold or which sectors are actually the best ones to be in, given what the Federal Reserve is up to or the federal government, you deserve to talk to somebody who can answer those and has a few gray hairs and has been there through some of the economic cycles because, hey, we're in another economic cycle. So it's good to have that experience. Fortunately, at Peak Financial Investing, what we do is we go out and we scour and we look for the very best firms out there who satisfy one thing above all else. They've got great experience coupled to great customer service. So if you want to come by peakfinancialinvesting.com, there's a very simple form you can fill out. Just a few fields. You hit send. What happens is an email gets triggered out. It goes to an endorsed firm of ours. You will get an email back. You can then set up a phone call for a 30 to 45 minute free, no obligation, no pressure call to find out if this firm is a good fit for you and to find out if you're a good fit for the firm. It has to go both ways. And if all that matches up, this will be one of the best things that could happen to you this year. So please come by peakfinancialinvesting.com. Very simple process. We would love to help you if we can. Thanks very much.